Okay, so I'd like to tell you about some new results concerning anti-de Sitter space, which were discovered last year. The first paper that came out was this beautiful paper by Piotr Bizon and his collaborator. Oscar Diaz, George Santos, and I then generalized that result, and we're continuing to develop those ideas in collaboration now with Don Maroff. So the plan for the talk is the following. I'm going to first give you a statement of the instability and some motivation for it. Then I'll give you evidence for the instability. Along the way, we'll encounter a new class of special solutions of Einstein's equation with ADS boundary conditions called ADS geons. I'll describe them. And then I'll ask the question, are all asymptotically anti-de Sitter solutions unstable? That turns out to be an interesting question with a possibly even more interesting answer. And we will discuss that. And finally, I'll end with some homework problems for the numerical relativists.
So we've got 10 years?
No, they're due on Friday. They're the last problem I did in 10 years. They're worth waiting for. Okay, so we're going to consider asymptotically anti-de Sitter solutions to pure gravity with a negative cosmological constant in four space-time dimensions. You can consider higher dimensions if you want. You can add matter if you want, but it's not necessary. What is necessary is that the solutions will asymptotically approach ADS globally. The results I'm going to tell you do not hold in the Poincaré patch. So these spacetimes can formally look like the interior of a solid cylinder. And if you require that the metric conformally approach the standard static cylinder at infinity, waves in the interior bounce off infinity and return in finite time. These theories are dual to quantum field theories that live on S2 cross R. And in particular, it's the finite volume that the field theory lives on, which is going to be important for these results. And that's why they don't hold in the Poincaré patch. Now, at the linearized level, anti-de Sitter appears just as stable as Minkowski space or de Sitter space-time. The perturbations simply oscillate and grow and don't grow. They stay finite for all time. But in these other cases, in both Minkowski space or de Sitter space-time, it's been shown that small and finite perturbations also remain small. And that's never been shown for anti-de Sitter space. So it's not natural to ask why not. And the answer is simply that it's not true. So the claim is that anti-de Sitter is non-linearly unstable. This was first suggested 5 years ago independently by Anderson in a physical argument and de Fermos and Holzickel in a mathematical argument. I'll give you those arguments in a minute. But first of all, the claim, we'll see that generic, small, but finite perturbations of anti-de Sitter become large and eventually form black holes. The energy appears to cascade from low frequency to high frequency modes in a manner reminiscent of the onset of turbulence. Now, one's first reaction to a statement like this might be, doesn't this contradict the fact that anti-de Sitter is supersymmetric? Doesn't it contradict the fact that there's a positive energy theorem? One sometimes hears a statement that if you have a positive energy theorem, the minimum energy solution is stable, even non-perturbatively. I've even made such statements in the past. But the short answer is no, there's no contradiction with these statements. And the reason is, the positive energy theorem says the following. If matter satisfies a reasonable local energy condition, then the total energy is greater than or equal to zero for all non-singular asymptotically anti-de Sitter initial data. And the energy is equal to zero if and only if the space-time is exactly anti-de Sitter space. Now, this theorem rules out the possibility that ADS decays. You cannot have a potential energy looking something like this because there's simply no other zero or negative energy states for it to decay into. So this is certainly ruled out, and there's no decay of anti-de Sitter space itself. But this theorem does not ensure that a small amount of energy added to anti-de Sitter space remain small. It could, in fact, generically form a small black hole. This possibility is usually ruled out by arguing that small perturbations disperse, that waves disperse, and that certainly doesn't happen in anti-de Sitter. A simple example illustrating these different notions of stability was given to me by the mathematician de Fermos. So consider the following theory, just general relativity coupled to a massless scalar field. This theory has a positive energy theorem, and it also satisfies nonlinear stability in the sense that small nonlinear perturbations of Minkowski space remain small. But now let's just change the sign of the kinetic energy term for the scalar field. Now the scalar field carries negative energy. There's no positive energy theorem in this theory. Nevertheless, it's still nonlinearly stable in the sense that the waves of the scalar field will still disperse and small nonlinear perturbations remain small. I'm going to claim that anti-de Sitter is a counterexample going the other way. Even though it has a positive energy theorem, it's nonlinearly unstable because small perturbations will grow.
Small in amplitude, do you mean? In the second case, is it really stable nonlinearly?
Yes, there's a certain norm, absolutely. There's a certain norm on the space of initial data.
It doesn't allow too much energy to somehow be, too much negative energy to be accumulated.
There's some norm, probably. It's one of these Sobolev norms, which involves sort of integrals of the field and its first couple derivatives. And the claim is that if you pick a small number, or you can pick a small number, so that if your norm is smaller than that, then you have global existence.
If it was oscillating very, very fast, even at a small amplitude, you want to imagine it's having enough energy.
But that has a lot of energy if it oscillates really fast. So yeah, it's small in some norm.
So it's a norm.
It's a norm thing. It's not just an amplitude smallness.
Yeah.
No, sure.
So,
yeah, small is in some suitable norm, which is not just measuring the amplitude.
I see.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's an open set. I mean, this norm gives you a topology, and there's a whole open set of initial data around Minkowski space for which the perturbations stay small and disperse. Okay, so what is the motivation that leads people to think that ADS might be nonlinearly unstable? The physical argument was given by Michael Anderson, and he simply said the anti-de Sitter boundary conditions act like a confining box. Any finite amount of energy which is added to this box might be expected to eventually explore all configurations consistent with the conserved charges, and that includes small black holes. So it's sort of an ergodicity argument that you would expect black holes to eventually form. De Fermos and Holzigel had a mathematical argument just coming from the structure of nonlinear PDEs. They noticed that the linearized perturbations don't grow, but they're certainly not decaying. Right, they oscillate with constant amplitude. If you imagine computing higher order corrections, you're going to have a source for your higher order corrections, which comes from the lower order terms and their derivatives. That source is not going to decay. It's going to stay constant for all time. And therefore, you might imagine that when you integrate your higher order perturbations, something will grow. There's yet a third motivation, which comes from the singularity theorems of general relativity. Hawking and Penrose proved a singularity theorem showing that closed universes are generically singular. Now, anti-de Sitter is not, strictly speaking, a closed universe, but it certainly acts like a closed universe for the fields inside because they bounce off infinity and come back in finite time. So one might expect that that's also generically singular. Now, I say generically singular because I'm going to argue that there are special solutions which are non-singular. And these are these ADS geons. So I'm going to argue that for some, possibly all, individual linearized modes of the gravitational field, there are corresponding exact nonlinear solutions, which we call these ADS geons. The name comes from Wheeler, who said if you have a lump of gravitational energy held together by its own self-gravity, it will be a geon. In asymptotically flat space-time, there's no exact geons, but in anti-de Sitter space, there are. These solutions are completely non-singular. So in particular, they contradict this original motivation, which said that any finite excitation which is added to ADS should become a black hole. I'm going to argue that's not true. There are very special sort of initial data, if you want, that that form these non-singular solutions. They're non-singular, as I said, globally asymptotically anti-de Sitter. There are an infinite number of them, because you can do this for a large class of linearized modes. But they're all special. They're certainly not generic solutions. They're special because, for one thing, they're exactly periodic in time. And secondly, they're invariant under a continuous symmetry, which is a linear combination of time translation and a rotation. So you can think of these as sort of rigidly rotating objects analogous to boson stars. Yes?
The question, so individual Jerome is a soliton, you say. So it will exist. Now, if you have two or more, there are something like non-scattering theorem?
No. That's
so if you have several, they will make a black hole.
Exactly. That's the whole way. If you try to put two geons together, they're going to interfere and produce a black hole. So the idea is that you form these by picking one linearized gravitational mode. The minute you start with a superposition of more than one, you'll get the generic instability.
But they have to be invariant under a continuous symmetry, or that's what you found?
That's what we find, yeah. Okay, that's the claim. I can't prove rigorously either the instability or the existence of these geons. All I can do is give you evidence for them. So the evidence starts with a brute force attempt to construct a solution. So let's do that. You do that by just perturbing, find the solution in a perturbation expansion. You start with anti-de Sitter space and consider now a whole series of higher order corrections. At each order, we have to solve an equation which looks like this. The right-hand side, the source, comes from all the lower order perturbations and their derivatives. The left-hand side is a wave equation involving this sort of Lichnerowitz operator. That's just this sort of complicated second order differential equation involving the background curvature of anti-de Sitter space and some things like that. Now, it's convenient to take advantage of the fact that the background is spherically symmetric and classify the perturbations in terms of spherical harmonics. So there are scalar-type perturbations, which are essentially constructed from the spherical harmonics and their derivatives. There are vector-type perturbations, which are constructed from the vector harmonics. On S2, these are particularly simple. They're just the two-dimensional dual of the gradient of the usual spherical harmonics. In higher dimensions, we'd also have to consider tensor harmonics. But fortunately, if we start in four dimensions, we only have a two-sphere, and there are no tensor harmonics on S2. So we only have to worry about these two type of perturbations. It turns out that at each order, you can reduce that tensor equation into two scalar equations, two two-dimensional wave equations for a variable phi. Now, phi was first introduced by Kodami and Ishibashi. It's a gauge invariant measure of the perturbation. You have two of them, one for the vector perturbations and one for the scalar perturbations. And you can reconstruct the actual metric perturbation in a particular gauge from phi by taking derivatives in a certain way. These gauge invariant variables satisfy, as I said, this two-dimensional wave equation, where the source, the scalar source, is just constructed from the components of the source we had a moment ago. This is some known potential function. And this is the two-dimensional wave operator associated with just the RT part of anti-de Sitter space. Now, of course, there's boundary conditions. We demand regularity at the origin, which tells us that phi has to sort of fall off or grow like r to the l for the lth mode. At infinity, you can show that the general solution has a leading order term, a 1 over r correction, and higher order corrections. Physically, we want to demand that our perturbation vanish at infinity. Physically, the h's, all those perturbations of the metric, have to go to 0. It turns out that when you reconstruct the metric perturbation from phi, the condition that the metric perturbation vanish is not that this leading order term vanish, which is what you might have expected, but in fact that this first subleading term vanish. So we demand that S vanishes in order that the metric perturbation actually vanishes at infinity. So now you can just start the calculation. At first order, this is the usual linearized modes. There's no sources. You find that the allowed frequencies for the gravitational perturbations are just these. It's 1 plus L plus 2P, where P indicates the radial excitation. These solutions are all known explicitly. And in particular, for P equals 0, the lowest mode, for each L, the solution takes this particularly simple form. So now you can say something about the general structure of this perturbation expansion. If the source has harmonic time dependence, say going like cosine omega t, then the solution will have the same harmonic time dependence, except if omega happens to agree with one of the original normal mode frequencies. In that case, you get a resonance, and the general solution includes a term growing with time.
So yes? The normal modes of documented ADS, is that correct?
Yes, yes. The normal modes of the original perturbed ADS that we had, these modes. These are the sort of the regular normal mode frequencies. And so then you get a resonance, and the general solution includes a term which oscillates like the source, but a second term which grows linearly in t. This is exactly like driving a harmonic oscillator at the resonant frequency. Okay, so now we can give a couple of examples. So the first example, we're going to start with a single mode, just the L equals 2, M equals 2 excitation. And you plug it into that equation, you compute the second order source, and the second order correction has no resonances. So you can compute that in a straightforward manner. At third order, you discover one resonant term. So it might appear that the general solution is then going to start growing with the term linear in t. But it turns out you can set the coefficient of that growing mode to 0 by changing the frequency of the mode very slightly. So if you take the frequency, which is initially 3 for this L equals 2 mode, and decrease it by a small amount, this sort of particular multiple of our perturbation parameter squared, the coefficient of the growing mode is set to 0. And now we believe you can continue in this way and construct the non-singular geon. Now, why do we say that? Well, you can show quite generally that there are not going to be any resonances at any even order. After we put out a paper, there were several people who came to us and said, oh, but this isn't much evidence. There are examples where you have trouble at fifth order. So George heroically sat down and calculated the fifth order correction to the metric and found that it's exactly like the third order, behaves exactly like this third order correction. There is, again, one resonant term, which can again be removed by a slight shift of the frequency, now proportional to epsilon to the fourth. Okay, so this is the evidence that so you can continue in this perturbative way and presumably construct a solution which is non-singular. Now, the symmetry of this mode.
The prefactor of that epsilon doesn't grow.
Well, we only have two terms in the series.
Between
the two terms, it doesn't grow, right? It's order one.
It increases a little bit more than this,
meanwhile, it could decide to pick up.
It's not a proof. Yeah. It could start growing after the 17th term. You know, we don't know.
The first two terms are smallish. The next one is even smaller, but we don't know what happens afterwards.
And everything's always proportional to the L equals 2, M equals 2 spherical harmonic?
That the resonant mode.
So in particular, you could write down a nonlinear set of equations that would just depend on T.
Oh, bar. No.
No? Okay.
There are many more. Go ahead.
They mix all the modes, the vectors and the scalars. That's why you have to solve a lot of ODEs to get to this result at third.
I see.
You have to solve like 100 ODEs or something like that.
Ouch.
It doesn't decouple.
Okay.
No, you got to solve them all.
It's
on the
Okay.
So the symmetry of the solution comes about because the linearized mode has some sort of cosine omega t minus m phi dependence. Right? So at the linearized order, there's a symmetry, which is some linear combination of d by dt and d by d phi. The sources are powers of that type of dependence. And so the solution continues to maintain a symmetry of that form, a sort of linear combination of d by dt and d by d phi. Interestingly enough, because the frequency is getting shifted, it's not exactly the same. The exact solution doesn't have exactly the same symmetry as the linearized solution. It gets deformed a little bit. But the symmetry certainly seems to be preserved at each order.
Could it be that it gets shifted to some other resonance?
Some other resonance.
I mean,
oh, you mean if it goes down enough or something?
I forgot. What are the original omegas?
It's they're over here somewhere. They just oh, so they, 1 plus L plus 2p. They're integers.
We, yeah, but it couldn't go down to 2 or something.
We certainly see no evidence for it.
It could not go down to 2, I think.
Because epsilon, you can, yeah.
L has to be bigger or equal than 2 in that expression.
So if you go
down, there's nothing down.
Okay.
But the exact solution is a helical killing vector.
Right.
One could convert numerically using a helical killing vector code or something.
Yes.
So we'll talk about that later. But yes, if you have a helical killing vector code, it would be ideal to search for these ions. Exactly. Although there's some special features which we'll come to. Okay, that was example one. Here's example two. We now start with a linear combination of two modes, the L equals 2, M equals 2 mode, and an L equals 4, M equals 4 mode. Now you start turning the crank, and at second order, you again find no problem, no resonances. You can find right down the solution. At third order, there are now 4 resonant terms. The growing mode in 2 of them can be removed by adjusting the 2 frequencies of the original modes, just as we saw before. The growing mode in 1 of them just happens to vanish. That you impose the boundary conditions at the origin and infinity that you want physically, and the coefficient is just 0. So you luck out there, but there remains 1 resonant term, and that cannot be removed. So that corresponds, interestingly enough, to a higher frequency mode in L equals 6, M equals 6 mode with omega equal to 7. So this mode is turned on with a growing amplitude. You get a growing mode with higher frequency than any of the modes we start with. Energy is, of course, conserved, so the energy must be transferred to this higher frequency mode. Now, we believe this will continue, so if you go to higher order, there'll be higher resonances turning on higher frequency modes, and it will just continue. And we believe it will eventually end up in a black hole. Now, why do we say that? Well, we didn't attempt to numerically integrate these general perturbations. But if you simplify the problem, you can do a lot more. So that's what Bizon and his collaborator did. They considered spherically symmetric collapse in anti-de Sitter space. So they just considered a massless scalar field and considered the spherical collapse. David Garfinkel talked about this a bit in his talk earlier in this week, so let me just be very brief and remind you the situation when lambda 0. When lambda 0, say an asymptotically flat space, you start with any profile you want for the scalar field with some amplitude alpha, and you know that when alpha is large, there's a lot of energy in the scalar field, it collapses to form a large black hole. When alpha is small, it's a very weak perturbation of Minkowski space. The waves scatter and go off to infinity, and there's no singularities. Alpha is a continuous parameter, so you can tune it to a critical value, which is marking the onset of black hole formation. The collapse then forms something you might think of as a zero-mass black hole, which is really just a naked singularity. And near this critical amplitude, if you're slightly above it, Chaptuik found that the mass of the black hole you form has this nice sort of, well, critical exponent type behavior. It goes like alpha minus the critical amplitude to a power gamma, where gamma numerically is about 0.37. This exponent is universal in the sense that it's independent of the profile of your initial data. So you can change f any way you want. You tune to find the critical alpha, and you always get a behavior like this with the same value of gamma. That's the asymptotically flat case. What happens if you do this in ADS? Okay, so here's a plot taken from this paper by Bizon and his colleague. What's plotted here is the radius of the initial black hole that's formed versus the amplitude of the initial data. If we start over on the far right, These are large amplitude perturbations. They collapse and form black holes, just like in flat space. This is the mass of the black hole. So this is like the calculations, I guess, David Garfinkel was talking about. And you tune it down, and you find, indeed, that this mass goes to zero at a critical value of the amplitude. And they checked the behavior near this critical point and found that it was exactly like in flat space. So you're forming zero-mass black holes with the same critical behavior as in flat space. In flat space, that would be the end of the story. In anti-de Sitter, it's just the beginning. Because if you take an amplitude smaller than that, the wave comes in, scatters, doesn't form a black hole, goes out to infinity, bounces back, and forms a black hole on the second try. So these are the black holes that are formed on the second pass. Start off rather large. You continue to tune the amplitude smaller and smaller. Those black holes get smaller and smaller, and you find a second critical amplitude. Near the second critical amplitude, you find exactly the same critical behavior as you did in flat space with exactly the same exponent.
How much is alpha star?
What's that?
How much is alpha star?
How much is alpha star? Well, that is not a universal thing. I mean, that depends very much.
In the job doing case.
Again, alpha star depends on the details of your initial data.
Oh, I see.
It changes when you change your initial profile. So that's not the interesting parameter. The interesting parameter is the exponent, or one of the interesting
parameters. I was just seeing that alpha first increases, and then it sort of decides that it has to fall. So I was thinking that maybe just after a few bounces.
Yeah, there's not.
No. Okay.
Okay. So you get a second critical point here. You continue to decrease. The wave now goes through. You started off, you know, with an amplitude in this region. It scatters, goes off to infinity, scatters back. Second time, doesn't do anything interesting, bounces off infinity. On the third try, it forms a black hole. And these are the black holes on the third try. And again, you can tune it down to get another third critical point behaving just like all the others. And it repeats. And every time they took the amplitude smaller and smaller, they found this pattern repeating. And you get a whole series of critical points with the black holes forming later and later because they have to bounce off infinity more and more times. But they didn't stop with this. They wanted to know what happens if you had a really small amplitude. So they did a long time evolution. And now what they do is they basically just look at the scalar curvature at the origin. It's spherically symmetric. You have a nice origin. The scalar curvature is going to oscillate because the waves are bouncing off infinity many, many times. It takes a time of about 2 pi to bounce off infinity and come back. So the scalar curvature is oscillating with a period of about 2 pi. If you take just the maximum of the scalar curvature in each oscillation and plot that as a function of time, you get a plot which looks like this. So this is the maximum scalar curvature as a function of time. Notice that these are long time evolutions. The time goes up to 1600 here in units of the ADS sort of time, the ADS radius. The four different curves correspond to different amplitudes. This is sort of largish amplitude, smaller, smaller, and smaller. So what's happening is that there's a period initially where the curvature is not growing very much. This is a linear regime. Things are oscillating. It's not growing too much. Something happens, and the curvature starts to grow. Notice the log scale. So this actually represents exponential growth of the curvature. Clearly, the nonlinearities have set in. Something else happens, and it starts growing even faster, and then even faster. And all of these evolutions end in a black hole. They followed them all to make sure that black holes form. So this is clearly evidence of an instability. But they also noticed something else. If you rescale, these are those four plots now on a rescaled axis. What they do is they rescale the time by the amplitude squared. They rescale the scalar curvature by 1 over the amplitude squared. And now the plots all coincide. These points off the axis here are the largest amplitude run. So they're viewed as sort of not yet being in the asymptotic regime. But as you take the amplitude smaller and smaller, all the points are lying along a fixed curve on this plot. Yes?
This is obviously a question, but what are the kinks? What is it that happens?
Yeah. Well, it's not at all a silly question. I mean,
it's beginning goes to zero.
It's okay. The first kink here is clearly associated with the onset of the nonlinear instability, some sort of resonance effect, you know, kicking in here and setting it off on some nonlinear growth. This, it's less clear. Some sort of higher order resonance, higher order instabilities, or something. It's very suggestive. There's a universal behavior here which was not known before. I would say it's not understood exactly.
But it's not more than one resonance. You know, it's a series of resonances.
Well, there are many resonances that come on. You see that in perturbation theory.
Sure.
But exactly what triggers these, I would say, is not.
Well, they probably were triggered at the very beginning, except that they were a lot smaller and they were growing all along,
yeah.
And at some point they overtake
the other.
Yeah, they just get big. I mean, they're growing faster, yeah. So they just get big enough to dominate the scalar curve.
Yeah, so there's nothing getting triggered.
Yeah, it's not a kink. It's something little.
Finally grows to sort of take over.
Yeah.
Okay, that makes sense.
So it starts growing from numerical errors at time zero. Where does it start growing from?
Not numerical errors. I mean, it's basically small and it's sourced by the nonlinearities. But you only see it on this curve when it gets big enough to be bigger than the other stuff. So you want to think of all these modes as growing at this rate all along, but their amplitude is so big, you don't see them until they dominate.
I see.
That still seems to be quite unusual. Sharp kinks in the solution of nonlinear equations.
Well, they're not that sharp. I mean, come on, this is very long. This is very long time step. So I'm sure if you look at it finally between 1900 and 2100, this will not show a kink, right? This is some smooth curve, which just because we've shrunk it down.
I agree with you. If what David says is right, then essentially it looks like we still have three or four kinds of modes with different exponential growth rates competing with. As if they were linear. As if, I'm not saying they are, but so I think there is something to be explained still.
Well, you see plots like this backwards in textbooks when you look at, radioactive decay, right? I mean, you have, sort of two different things and you have a tiny amount of this stuff, but it decays, at a slower rate. And so if on a log plot, your radioactive decay is dominated by the more abundant, more rapidly decaying species first, and so you get a line, and then it's dominated by the less abundant but more slowly decaying species, and on a log plot you get a line too. So I mean, it's exactly the same thing.
Right.
Here, except here you have exponential growth, but you have exponential growth at different rates.
Well, if you do this Fourier transform on this plot on pi first, and then redo this plot, you're going to see four different lines that are growing at different rates at this standard rate.
It's
a log.
Yeah. It's log. No, I mean it looks like a linear process, like
David was saying. So you say that like superposition of like four different processes which take over.
A linear superposition of four different processes, yes, which is strange.
It is strange, as this is.
Yeah. I mean, his radioactivity is also linear.
Yeah. Yeah, but then you don't get black holes at the end of radioactivity.
Makes it possible.
Yes.
The
fact that it's epsilon squared
that
you have the scalar
is obvious. No. In fact, that's exactly my next point. It's a very important observation that we're scaling time like epsilon squared, which is telling us that the time to form a black hole scales like 1 over the amplitude squared.
Does that have to do anything with epsilon squared and the shift
atomicness? No. And the point I want to make here is that this is much faster than you might expect from a purely ergodic process. So if you're putting the energy down at random and letting it sort of scatter among all possible states, you'd expect something which would grow exponentially with, something like 1 over the amplitude. And the reason that it's much faster than a sort of purely ergodic process is because the normal mode frequencies of anti-de Sitter space are all integer multiples of a given fundamental ADS frequency. So there are lots of resonances. In this process, ADS is much more than a typical box. It's actually a very symmetric box, and it has a lot of resonances. And I think that's ultimately responsible for this fast black hole formation rate.
Since you just mentioned that, I wanted to ask about the existence of the stationary solutions.
Yeah. Well, they're not.
Is that a special property of the ADS background?
Let's see. We haven't checked it in any other case. We've talked about the possibility of geons built on, say, the ADS soliton or some other geometry. So I guess it's not known, but...
Well, surely you must have both the reflecting walls to have a helical cooling back.
Oh, absolutely.
If you make a small change in the radial component, you know, some radial dependence of a metric component, so you lose some of the symmetry of ADS, but you keep the basic thing the same as a box.
Right.
Would you lose those things?
Would you lose the geons?
Yes.
I'm not sure at the moment. I had thought they would exist, and now I'm having my doubts. I mean, we don't really have any evidence one way or the other. They may not exist in general.
If you do something that decodes the resonances, the geons get easier to make. Yeah.
In some way, this geon, my picture of it was that it's not axisymmetric, so it's radiating gravitational waves, which are bouncing off the boundary and coming back coherently,
right.
So that the whole thing is just...
Right.
But if there are too many independent frequencies, then it can't come back coherently and support the stationary structure.
It's a good question. I think it needs to be investigated.
Yeah, the nonlinear systems which do not have that much symmetry would go to chaos, which instead of exponent would have diffusion behavior. It will randomly work, but not grow exponentially, but start diffusing randomly. Usually this is what happens.
Did it exist if you decided to put the theory on something other than a sphere, like a torus or something like that?
Yeah, so if you put it on a torus, there is an analog of this. Of course, the thing that you need is for the waves to bounce back and forth many, many times.
Right.
So it doesn't work in the Poincaré patch because the Poincaré patch, you bounce off infinity and everything is lost through the Poincaré horizon. Now, what happens if you compactify, you know, the Poincaré patch into a torus? If you basically break supersymmetry by modifying boundary conditions for fermions, there is a simple gravitational analog or dual of that known as the ADS soliton. That's a spacetime which has an infrared cutoff at a finite radius, finite volume at infinity. So the waves indeed bounce around infinitely often. So the same instability that we talked about should hold in that case. And Ted was asking whether, we were just discussing whether geons might exist in that case as well. It's a good question. They might, but I'm not sure. Okay, so. The conclusion of this study of the spherically symmetric scalar field evolution is that no matter how small you make the initial amplitude, the curvature at the origin always grows, and you eventually form a small black hole. So let's now ask, what's the end state of the general perturbation if you're not in spherical symmetry? Now, your first thought would be, well, a curved ADS black hole. You take some perturbation with some angular momentum, and you expect it to collapse and form a Kerr ADS black hole. But it might not be that, because the Kerr ADS black hole might itself be unstable. Why do I say that? Well, very recently, and like this came out just a few months ago, Holzigal and his collaborator argued that a linear scalar field evolved outside a Kerr ADS black hole. They gave some estimates. They said it probably decays very slowly, like 1 over log t. And this was, in fact, confirmed numerically in work by George Santos. So this is a very surprising result. I had always thought that if you perturb, you take, a scalar field outside of a Kerr ADS black hole, the evolution will be governed by the quasi-normal modes, and that means it'll decay exponentially. So I had always expected it to decay exponentially. Why are they getting such a long, very, very slow decay?
Is this only very late times inside or something?
Yeah. This is a late time result. Yes, very late times. And the reason is that the high angular momentum modes are trapped by an angular momentum barrier. And even though they have a non-zero imaginary part, that imaginary part is going to zero exponentially quickly with the angular momentum quantum number L. So we heard in Paul Chesler's talk yesterday that in the Poincaré patch, when you have planar symmetry and you look at modes with very high momentum, the imaginary part of the quasi-normal mode frequencies goes to zero, like 1 over q to the 1/3. Okay, so again, they last a long time because those frequencies are going to zero, but they're only going to zero like a power law. In global ADS, these modes have an imaginary part going to zero exponentially quickly. That allows them to hang around much longer and give you this very, very slow decay. You now couple this with the sort of nonlinear PDE intuition that if your linear modes don't decay very fast, the nonlinear perturbations are likely to grow. And so that led de Fermos, among some others, to say all asymptotically anti-de Sitter solutions are probably unstable, meaning Kerr ADS could itself be unstable. So we've been thinking about what this means together with Don, and it appears that this instability is very similar to the instability of ADS we just talked about. It's the result of the very high angular momentum modes. These very high angular momentum modes are subject to this very large centrifugal barrier. They're essentially trapped in a region away from the black hole. And if the modes are trapped there, they're going to bounce back and forth. They sort of zoom around on the sphere at large radius, interact nonlinearly, and likely to form a black hole there. In other words, we're looking at a black moon, a little black hole being formed at some large radius from your central Kerr ADS black hole. Now, how might you show this? Well, one approach that we're pursuing is to look at the quasi-normal modes of the Kerr ADS black hole. Those are known to approach the quasi-normal modes of, well, not quasi, the actual normal modes of pure ADS when L becomes large. I just told you the imaginary parts are going to zero, and the real parts approach the real frequencies of the ordinary normal modes of ADS. Of course, that's expected, because I just told you these modes are trapped at very large radius. And at very large radius, the metric looks like anti-de Sitter space, and so doesn't really see much of a perturbation due to the black hole. Now, if the time to form a black hole is short enough so that the difference between the actual quasi-normal mode frequencies of the black hole is between that and the pure ADS doesn't matter, then the evolution will be just like an ADS, and you will expect a black hole to form.
What is the argument that you can't just have a bunch of gravity waves in rotating orbit around this rotating black hole and just have a stationary state that looks like that?
Well, let's see. So you would have to these modes will generally decay. Okay, so if you just think about it, they would have some potential barrier which traps them there for a while. But if you just think about it as some gravitational waves in that potential well, and you don't include any nonlinear instabilities or anything, you would expect those waves to eventually fall in at late times.
Ah, okay.
So you form a new pocket, and a new pocket also creates black holes.
Yeah.
You wait long enough.
So that's the intuition here. Okay, I'm saying this is very much work in progress. We're trying to make arguments like this work. At the moment, it appears to be easier to make this work in higher dimensions. So it might turn out that this mechanism is true, but not in four dimensions. I don't know yet. We're still thinking about it. But what does this mean? Okay, now let's ask about the late time behavior of the space-time. Well, suppose it's true, then you form this black moon. But that's not the end of the story. The black moon will typically decay as it spirals into the original black hole. And in the process, it'll radiate a little bit of energy. So you end up with a slightly bigger black hole in the center with a bit less energy outside. But that energy will have, that radiation will have a high angular momentum tail, which will again be trapped and form another black moon, which will again spiral in, radiating a little bit of energy, which could again cause another black moon. And if this indeed continues indefinitely, you end up essentially violating cosmic censorship. You're not forming naked singularities in finite time, because we expect it to take long time for these small black moons to form, but you're certainly getting large curvature outside the horizon. And if you ask, well, can you get Planck curvature in finite time? This would this would seem to be a mechanism to do it.
Wait, it's outside of the original horizon, but maybe inside the new horizon.
Well, it would be on the, it would be near the horizon of the new black hole. Mm-hmm. So the idea is that if you form successively smaller and smaller black holes through some sort of instability in this way, by staying outside but close to the horizon of the new black hole, you would be seeing large curvatures. And that certainly is violating the spirit of cosmic censorship.
In higher dimensions, could it form a black Saturn?
That is, well, we believe these black rings are sort of unstable. So it's not likely to settle down to a black Saturn. Yeah.
They're unstable in anti-de-Sitter.
We probably unstable. The Gregory Laflamme instability is sort of local. Any long strip of black string should probably be unstable.
There is another
ring.
The ring probably sits in the same position.
It would be at, roughly that radius.
I mean, roughly,
it would be at the same radius, yeah. But we expect that, you know, there'll be perturbations of all different sizes. More likely you'll form little black holes than one uniform black ring at that point.
Another argument for the rings to be unstable, they're super radiant, like rings, in areas. They're expected to be super radiant.
Even if all of this is correct, there is a subtlety that we have to deal with. There's a slight complication, and that is that there are non-coalescing binaries in anti-de Sitter space. In other words, I claim there are binaries for which the gravitational waves that would normally be produced simply bounce off infinity, come back, and support the orbit. The gravitational radiation is essentially in a standing wave, and the orbit continues indefinitely and doesn't coalesce.
Stable.
It's stable in a certain sense, unstable in another sense, and I'll explain that in a minute, okay? okay, so let's look at this possibility, and I claim there's a simple argument, a simple way to actually construct these non-coalescing binaries. And so in our context, that would correspond to special orbits of the black moon, which would not spiral in, but would just sort of want to sit there. So how do you construct those special orbits? Well, you start with a Kerr, a rotating black hole in anti-de Sitter space. There's a killing field in these space-times, which is null on the horizon. And that killing field can be written as a combination of the time translation and rotation with some angular velocity omega. Now, if the angular velocity is bigger than 1, then it's easy to show that there's a certain radius at which the killing vector becomes tangent to a geodesic. Okay, most of the time, orbits of killing fields are not geodesics. But in this case, if omega is bigger than 1, you can show that there's a special radius at which the orbit is tangent to a geodesic. These are circular orbits, which are invariant under the killing field. And indeed, these orbits are stable for certain black holes. So for a certain class of black holes, you can show that these are stable circular orbits. Now, you just replace the geodesic by a small black hole. This will create a metric perturbation. But that perturbation will be invariant under the symmetry. So in particular, you know, because the symmetry is the horizon generator, there's no flux of energy across the horizon of the black hole. So the original black hole doesn't change. It's not going to grow. And the original black hole just sits there on its stable orbit.
The condition, so to say, rotates together with it.
Yeah.
It's exactly
rotates. There's some gravitational sort of wave background, which is just all invariant under this, this common killing vector. OK, so we've done some calculations in constructing these solutions perturbatively. And they seem to exist, giving these non-coalescing binaries. And because these are stable circular orbits, if we now sort of go back to our scenario, black moons that are created farther out might be expected to sort of approach the stable orbit and then just get hung up and not want to go any farther. But there's another instability. These are stable circular orbits for sort of, you know, radial perturbations. But I told you that to construct it with this method, we need an angular velocity bigger than 1. And that leads to another instability due to super radiance. So I'll just remind you that if you have a wave with sort of frequency omega and azimuthal quantum number m, and you scatter that off of a rotating black hole in anti-de Sitter space, if the angular velocity is bigger than 1 and the frequency is less than m times omega, then you'll have the wave scatter off the black hole with bigger amplitude than it went in. That's a process called superradiance. It's extracting energy and angular momentum from the black hole. In asymptotically flat space-time, that's the end of the story. It scatters, comes back with bigger amplitude, and goes off to infinity. But of course, in ADS, it'll go off to infinity and bounce back to the black hole again. The outgoing wave comes back, scatters off the black hole again, grows again, keeps doing it, and you build up an instability. This is a superradiant instability. I want to emphasize this is different from the instability of anti-de Sitter space we've been talking about so far. This instability requires a black hole with large, you know, angular velocity, the so-called ergo region. The other instability is much more generic, happens in ADS itself, but they certainly interact with each other. If you look at the superradiant instability, it's going to have these modes grow, then they're going to start interacting nonlinearly because of the other, the resonances and stuff, and so it's going to become unstable that way. So the picture we have is that despite the fact there are non-coalescing binaries, if it gets hung up there, this superradiant scattering will decrease the angular velocity of the black hole, eventually bringing it down to 1, or about 1, so that the superradiant is turned off, and then the process can continue. OK, so now let me say a few words about the implications for the dual field theory. This seems to be, first of all, not a problem at all for gauge gravity duality. And in fact, it's something that you might have expected, thinking from it from the dual field theory perspective. The fact that the perturbations evolve to black holes can be viewed as thermalization in a microcanonical ensemble. I want to emphasize this is not standard thermal states because little black holes are very hot. You have nowhere near enough energy to create an actual thermal state at that temperature in your gauge theory. But in a microcanonical ensemble where you fix the energy, you are evolving to a state of maximum entropy. And so that's like thermalization. Said that way, of course, seems perfectly intuitive and perfectly obvious. But I emphasize from the gravity perspective, the fact that you're taking these long wavelength modes and ending up with little tiny black holes is far from intuitively obvious. And I think until these results came out, everyone would have said that the small finite perturbed ADS would behave just like the linearized modes. They would just slosh around forever. The other thing to emphasize is that this is a result which only holds at large n, strictly infinite n. If you imagine the analogous question at finite n, of course, then the very tiny black holes are going to Hawking evaporate. The dominant entropy configuration will not be, if the energy is small enough, the dominant entropy configuration is going to be a gas of particles in ADS. You won't even form small black holes. You certainly can't excite any mode with frequency bigger than the initial energy you put into the system. And so there's all sorts of mechanisms to cut this off. But it still raises the question, what is the dual description of this instability in the large N gauge theory? Okay, we're claiming that there's some generic instability of ADS, so there should be some statement of that in the dual gauge theory. This is hard to see because the instability is associated with forming very small black holes. So the first question is, what is the dual description of a very small black hole? And that's something we don't have a good answer for. But if there was an operator, which you could call the small black hole operator in your gauge theory, you would expect that to keep sort of turning on in some sense in your for small perturbations of the gauge theory.
What's the dual description of Beton solution?
Sorry?
For simplicity, what's the dual description of Beton solution?
Beson solution?
Yeah, spherically symmetric with a scalar field, but which is zero at the boundary.
Well, that's some excited state. And generically, the excited state is going to thermalize. You end up with some black hole. And then you ask about tuning it to some critical amplitude. And there's these sort of small, you know, these naked singularities for very finely tuned initial states.
So what do they correspond to?
And I don't know. Very good question. So that's right. So for the very finely tuned amplitudes where you evolve to a naked singularity, I don't know what that means in the large N gauge theory. That's another good question.
What about evaporation of the black hole once it forms?
Well, I said very small black holes will evaporate. So there's several regimes, right? We know the black hole is big enough, it can be in thermal equilibrium with its Hawking radiation and it sits there. If the black hole is small enough, it evaporates completely. And so it depends on the initial energy, whether...
But then you'd think you just got an infinite cycle of evaporating and reforming and evaporating and reforming, no?
No, you won't form the black hole if the maximum entropy state is the Hawking radiation. Now, I suspect that the evolution...
You told us that every perturbation forms a black hole.
Classically, if you turn off Hawking radiation.
Yeah, but...
That was the infinite end, sort of no quantum effects allowed.
What would prevent it from forming the black hole is that the little black hole it tries to form first would evaporate too quickly.
I think that it might not form because it might just prefer to be this gas of radiation. It's evolving toward a maximum entropy state. And so if it prefers, I don't see why it would first go to a metastable lower entropy state and then hang around for a while and then evaporate. That's not how I would picture it. But
it just seems like there should be a perfectly good range of parameters there where you form a classical black hole, essentially classical, but eventually it evaporates.
Okay, maybe you're thinking about not finite n, but some perturbative correction to infinite n. Right. So if you do the infinite n calculation and then include 1 over n correction or something, maybe that would do something like that.
No, actually, I'm sorry. I think I just realized the problem. If it's big enough, then it's evaporating slowly, and anything it sends out falls back into it after bouncing off the boundary. So it actually can't evaporate.
Yes, in a gas it goes into contact, into formal equilibrium with a big gas. So it does not have a point.
Big one.
Okay, so this is the sort of instability, which seems like a perfectly innocuous thing. But now let's look at those very special gions. Those are high energy states in the gauge theory which are not thermalizing. So that's the puzzle. Right? Why aren't these things thermalizing? They, as I said, they're sort of periodic in time. They are never forming black holes. And that is not what we expected just from sort of thermodynamics in the gauge theory. There was another class of states coming out again earlier, late last year, which described states which don't thermalize.
No,
states
don't thermalize. It's badly described.
Well, they have a class of states which they construct by. Okay.
They don't become homogeneous. You know, there's extra symmetries, and
you thermalize
some charge to the extra symmetries. That charge, because it's a symmetry, never diffuses.
Great.
So it will remain. But
you would call that thermal.
I would call that thermal. Okay. Just like you have a rotating liquid, you can call it thermal, even though it's rotating.
Okay, so what David is saying, just to sort of fill in, the simplest example of these states is you take a black hole sitting at the center of ADS, and you simply boost it. In ADS, it's a simple boost, and the black hole will follow one of these sort of GD6, which sort of sloshes around, oscillates back and forth in anti-de Sitter space. If you look at the stress tensor that you construct from that solution, it has regions, you know, the energy density grows and then, you know, comes to one pole and the other pole and keeps sloshing back and forth indefinitely. So they say that this thing is not thermalizing. But as David says, there is a conserved charge associated with this symmetry. It's a conformal killing field of your boundary sphere, a conformal symmetry of the dual theory. The charge of the state is not zero for that conserved charge. It's a non-zero conserved charge. And so, sure, it's not going to decay, but it can still thermalize within the sector of states with that charge. Okay, so that's what I want to say is that our states are not like that. Okay, the gions we construct are in sort of, we construct them in the rest frame. We can boost them if we want. We can make our gions slosh back and forth also, but we don't do that. We look at them in a rest frame where it would seem that the only conserved quantities it has are the usual energy and angular momentum, and nevertheless, it is still not thermalizing. So we're left with a couple of questions. Why don't these states thermalize? And what is the space of states that don't thermalize? And how do we understand them from the dual field theory?
So usually solitons, if there are some integrable systems, we know they're not thermalized because they have non-trivial integrals of motion, which are not related to symmetry, so they're not just charges. Right?
Yeah. Maybe that's behind this. It'd be nice.
Well, you said if you scatter these guys.
They thermalize, yeah. You scatter them. The geons are stable to linearized perturbations, but are going to be unstable to nonlinear perturbations.
And the quantum effects, quantum random effects, are going to mix them. So eventually in the field theory, they are
yes. thermalized. So again, these are preferred states only at large n. As you say, at finite n, all the modes are turned on through quantum fluctuations, and so we expect these to thermalize as well. So it's a large n puzzle again.
And these are very nonlinear.
Very non-generic, yes.
There's a measure zero.
There's certainly a measure zero in the space of all states. Yeah, you need fine-tuning to see.
Yeah, you said it was stable linear theory.
Yes. Why is that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Could you imagine if you detune into one of these resonance things slightly?
You can make the following argument. Imagine, okay, these geons come with several parameters. I mean, one of the parameters is just sort of, well, they're angular momentum. There's a definite mass for angular momentum, and you can label them by the angular momentum along with some other quantum numbers. Okay, if the angular momentum is small, that means that the solution is close to ADS. We've just turned on a small amount of the geon. You now ask, what are the perturbations of that going to look like? Well, the normal modes, again, they're normal modes, not quasi-normal modes. There's no horizon. The normal modes of the geon will have frequencies that are close to the frequencies of ADS. Right, because you've just perturbed ADS a little bit in this finite way. So all the frequencies of ADS are positive. You know,
only the low-lying modes. I mean, once you get up to high-lying modes which see the geon, they could be quite deformed.
But there's still a continuous parameter we can tune. I don't see how.
I mean, you must affect the spectrum of normal modes by the geon.
You affect them.
There'll be modes that aren't affected.
I certainly expect to affect them, but I expect to affect them in a way which goes to zero as I take j to zero, because the j to zero limit is continuously mapped back to ADS.
Yeah, but there'll be some set of modes. You'll have to scale the set of modes you look at as you do.
So you're saying that for any j, if I go to high enough mode, you think that they might become unstable?
I guess the question is, are there any modes that become bound near the geon.
I don't think so. Not for small enough j. I can say mass. We can talk about the mass of it, not the angular momentum. It's the same thing.
But I think because you have to tune these various modes to stop the resonances, it just sounds like if you perturb a little bit I mean, you have to tune it so hard to get the thing.
Yeah, but
because it's essentially unstable.
Sometimes they create island of stability, as it is called. Okay? Mm-hmm.
At best, it's stable. It's a linearized perturbation, but not to finite perturbations. Yeah.
What fixes the size of this geons? You have this epsilon parameter.
Yeah, so epsilon can be replaced by the mass or the angular momentum. So physically, we have a one-parameter family of geons for every choice of quantum numbers L and M and radial excitation. So you take a particular linearized mode, and now you can construct the geon as a one-parameter family of solutions where you crank up the amplitude.
Epsilon, you're free to choose.
And it determines the mass or the angular momentum. They're related. Once you know one, you know the other. Okay, one more comment about the geons. There's been a lot of talk about the boundary stress tensor for various solutions. We computed the boundary stress tensor to a certain order from our solution for the geon. Turns out that this does contain some negative energy regions. The total mass is, of course, positive. But if you look at the energy density along the equator, it contains both positive and negative energy regions. The stress tensor is invariant under the Killing field that the geon is invariant under. So that's a linear combination of d by dt and d by d phi. M is this azimuthal quantum number that you start with when you pick your linearized mode. And omega is the corrected frequency of the final solution. This Killing field, since omega is bigger than M, is time-like near the poles, but space-like near the equator. So you have some state of your gauge theory with the stress tensor, which has sort of positive and negative energy density regions, which is zipping around faster than light. Okay, so that sounds a little bizarre until you realize that this is really just like a spotlight effect. That this is, we have some sort of object rotating in the center of ADS, and its projected energy densities on the boundary have this effect. And it's not surprising, because if you imagine constructing the state, you have to first of all take the operator dual to the metric, well, that's the stress sensor, but then you have to pick out a particular mode of your stress sensor. So you're doing an integral over all of space-time of the stress sensor weighted by e to the minus I omega t plus I m phi, and act with that on the vacuum. That creates the linearized, the state corresponding to the linearized metric perturbation. And then you put a lot of those modes together. It's a very non-locally constructed state. Right, so it's not surprising that you find these sort of funny correlations.
The size is roughly the radius.
Yeah, well, because you're on a sphere of a certain size, and you have these oscillations, you have roughly m, you know, different sort of positive and negative regions going around, something like that. Okay, well, I'm basically done. So the conclusions are, first of all, anti-de Sitter space-time is non-linearly unstable. Generic small perturbations become large and probably form black holes. Two, the resulting ADS black holes may also be unstable. Their evolution might produce these arbitrarily large curve, these arbitrarily smaller and smaller black moons, which would be arbitrarily large curvature outside the horizon. And finally, we argued that there are exact non-singular geons and non-coalescing binaries inside anti-de Sitter, or with anti-de Sitter boundary conditions. So here comes your homework. So here's the homework for numerical relativists. The first is to evolve a small perturbation of ADS and show that they form black holes. Okay, this, of course, is a difficult problem. You're going to need to evolve for a long time to see this, at least for small amplitudes. It would be interesting, I think. So here's a problem. I mean, if you take a lump of gravitational wave in ADS with sort of a lot of energy, it should form a black hole. That's, well, I'm not sure it's been done, but it certainly sounds doable. And now just crank the amplitude down. Try to see the first couple critical points that Bizon found for a gravitational wave.
Hasn't really been done in asymptotically flat spacetimes either.
Well, there was this very early work.
Yeah,
right?
Nobody's been able to repeat that.
Oh, it's Chuck Evans or something.
Yeah.
Interesting. Well, I'm not sure why, but it would be interesting just to see. I mean, intuitively, why would a scalar field, spherically symmetric scalar field, if it doesn't form a black hole on the first pass, it goes out to infinity and comes back, why would it want to form a black hole in the second pass? Wasn't obvious that it sort of these bounces focus the energy more and more. It would be already interesting, I think, to see that happening in gravity, just to sort of see that if it doesn't form a black hole in the first pass, it might form it on the second pass. Yeah.
Actually, your argument for the energy cascade from low frequencies to higher frequencies, it didn't involve the bounce, did it? It was just involving the normal modes of ADS itself. So presumably there should be this cascade happening even if something propagates.
No, no. The fact that we have discrete normal modes in ADS requires finite boundary
conditions. I'm just wondering if my physical picture announces it, as soon as it hits and then reflects back, that's when the mode happens. But it seems that it might not be the case, given the argument for that perhaps the mode mixing's happening.
I'm not quite sure what you're saying. Certainly from the numerical results that Bizon has, if the amplitude is small enough, you bounce many, many times before the nonlinearities really kick in. So you can get linear behavior for a while before you see these nonlinear effects. Okay, so that's one problem. Another one is to construct these geons explicitly. We gave some perturbative argument, but you know, it'd be nice to know that they actually exist as exact solutions, which can be found numerically. As already pointed out, the fact that these have a helical Killing field means that it's not really a 3 plus 1 problem, it's really a 2 plus 1 problem. But there's a catch. The catch is that the Killing field that the symmetry has is time-like in some region and space-like in another region. So the problem is a mixed hyperbolic elliptic system, and you need to know how to sort of put those pieces together. But it might be possible. It sounds like something worth thinking about. Finally, building on this, It'd be nice to evolve small perturbations of Kerr ADS black holes, or even Schwarzschild ADS black holes, I guess, and see if you find a black moon. Does the instability we talk about actually lead to small black holes forming at large radius? And finally, I talked about these non-coalescing binaries. Again, we have perturbative arguments that they exist, but it'd be nice to find them explicitly and see what the properties are. So I'll stop there. Thank you.
How do the first black holes that form from a generic perturbation look like? Do you start with like the first one to form at low angular momentum, or is it some fast moving?
No, I think the instability is always associated with large L nodes. So the picture is that they're going to form probably at large radius.
So you immediately start with moons, basically.
Yeah.
Very fast.
Right. If you're starting with these non-zero angular momentum modes, and you build up the higher and higher things, I think it's going to end up being, you might even get several, but it's likely to form at some large radius rather than sitting at the center, which is what the spherically symmetric glasses do.
You expect, so if these small black holes form and they continue to form and get smaller and smaller black holes, how would you expect that to manifest itself in the nuclear? Would you expect to see it in stress? Would you expect to see it in the emission spectrum of the plasma?
Well, again, it's to see the small black holes, we have to work in a large n limit.
Yes.
And to see it, we need to understand what the operator is, which sort of detects small black
right.
holes.
So for example, if you have a very small black hole, it's going to Hawking radiate a lot.
Not at large n. It doesn't Hawking radiate at all.
Well, but that's going to manifest itself in the emission spectrum of plasma at leading order and n. Right?
At leading order, at large n, there's no Hawking radiation. So you don't
see it. If you next to
you want to include some next to leaving order.
I'm looking at a 1 over n radiation.
Okay. Right? At a 1 over n effect.
And if I imagine measuring something like the emission spectrum, it's going to glow at some rate, right? And that should be related to the Hawking radiation.
It seems like it's a question of order of limits. One has to be careful how you set up the problem, because if you're in a situation where you're allowing this radiation, then, as I said before, I don't think the black hole will form in the first place. I think you're going to...
I'm talking about just ignoring the back reaction altogether. I'm just looking at correlation functions.
Okay, just the correlation function on the black hole background.
Should these little black holes show up in correlation?
Possibly, but I think you're going to need resolution. Right? So certainly any coarse grating, right, which is coarse grating over some reasonable region in your field theory, is not going to see a little... These little tiny black holes have very little mass, and so they have very little gravitational effect on the geometry and stuff. So if you're constructing any observable, which is sort of a coarse-grained observable for some sort of process, you're not likely to see much effect. But those little black holes you would see if you could get, I think, very close to them. And we can talk about that.
Okay. Just from a numerical relativity point of view, is it correct to say that you don't need to do full GR, you just in the background of Candida Zeta Orca ADS, just simulate a nonlinear scalar field wave equation? I mean, you won't form a black hole, but you'll form singularity.
It depends on the strength of the nonlinearities.
Sure. So if you pick it appropriately.
If you pick it appropriately, then I think there's little doubt that that's sort of a
but
better.
It's far less obvious in the Kerr ADS,
surely.
Because then it's, you know, then it's the normal
mode. Right. So in the ADS case,
yes.
You know, people have studied
absolutely.
Nonlinear wave equations. They studied it in the box, basically, a fixed torus box. And then, you know, you have phi to the n, and big enough, you can form singularities in finite time, and n is small enough. You have fields that grow, but they don't actually diverge in finite time. So now you say do that in ADS. So the linear problem is done by these people, George did the numerics for the linear problem, and see this low mechanic. So now you say, put a nonlinear interacting field outside of fixed curve background and see if you see the same growth you would expect. Yeah, that sounds like an interesting problem. I suspect you will, because I think that's
much, much easier problem.
Okay. It's a much easier problem, but I think the slow decay of the linear problem is almost guaranteeing that you'll see the growth of the nonlinear. But that'd be worth checking. It's not something that.
For this constructing the geon explicitly, what is known mathematically about how to, you know, set up a problem that's that sort of mixed hyperbolic estimate, right? I mean, for elliptic stuff, I'm supposed to set stuff up on the boundary. For hyperbolic stuff, I'm supposed to set initial data. I don't quite see how one is supposed to put those together. Is there something known about this?
Well, George and I were talking about this, so I went and when I saw the Fermats in Cambridge, I asked him, so what's known about these mixed. And he said, but next to nothing in terms of general theorems. It basically, you have to study each problem separately, and depending upon special features of the problem, sometimes you can make progress and sometimes you can't. So there's really no general results about how to.
Haven't people even done numerics for
yes.
Black hole binaries?
Well, no, first, yeah. So the Richard Price and company had a, Jim and Jim, John Friedman had a program to try to set quasi-circular orbits using this approach, and they had to face exactly this problem. And
but they figured it out, that's what I'm saying. Mathematics must have been figured out, yes.
They worked on it.
I think they did
really figured it out.
I remember from the literature, they didn't quite figure out, except the linear problem. The linear problem, they managed to solve it somehow, but then the non-linear, at least I have not managed to.
Right. Yeah, okay.
Maybe one more. So your drones look very bizarre, of course. They move with a superluminal speed, etc.
Right.
But on the other hand, the boundary has some hydro. Hydro does have some solitons, which in principle, like solitary waves and money, just moves and doesn't decay.
But not dissipative hydro, right?
Yeah, that's viscosity.
Yeah. But they're also only approximately not decaying. There's some
exact solution should not decay. At large end. At large end, the claim is the exact solution.
Classical. So they don't decay
at all.
But you have positive and negative energy, right? So that's presumably not a hydro state at all.
But yeah. I don't know. If it is kind of flat, we don't have bulk viscosity. We have only some shear viscosity. Maybe we can have solution where it is zero for some result. The shear viscosity doesn't do anything because of geometry. You may think of it. It's like flat. Maybe there are ways, no? This is a special conformal liquid which doesn't allow many viscosities not to last. And others can be excluded genetically. So maybe there are ways.
Any more questions?
Well, let's thank Gary. We're going to have a photo. June is.